accession number 120303.
Names of those members who had been killed or who died were read out, and back we went. And then we still had the little war in Japan to cope with. But between the two, there was the famous general election. And I had decided that it was quite impossible for me to be any sort of a mother, any sort of a wife, any sort of a member of Parliament. I couldn't have done it because the constituency was so demanding, so far from London, and so huge in mileage to cover. And so I'd quite decided I didn't want to continue. But there was another thing. I did not think that this country was ready for party politics. I had felt that the unity of the war should have been allowed to continue until such time as we had renewed the things that needed and set out on a new path. I was very much in the minority. Nobody much agreed with me. But that was another reason why I didn't want to fight the election.
What was the outcome of that election surprising to you? A Labour
government? My husband fought it as a Liberal in Bethnal Green, which I found very hard to swallow, but I liked him, so I had to. I didn't take any part in it, except to address envelopes. What did you ask me just now?
The outcome of the election.
Oh, the outcome of the election, of course it was a surprise. It was less of a surprise. I really believed that the country was not ready for it, so I thought, well, you know, so what? I was, you know, I felt rather pleased with myself for a moment. I think it was a very understandable situation.
How did the House of Commons also, how did it work for women? You know, the sort of facilities that it offered.
Well, we had a room we could go and chat in. There were very few of us. There are many more now. I think now they have a hairdresser and they have a, I don't know, they may have a day nursery for all I know. They certainly have a room where we never had, which is, I think, for meeting people or families or something or other. But it was all right. It was, they didn't like us much, you know. I'm not too sure they do today, but it's certainly easier today. More notice is taken of you. We had to fight for every inch of the road. I'm not a feminist, you see, so... So I was, I think one of the troubles perhaps has been in some cases that the women members of Parliament in the past found in politics and Parliament what they lacked in their own lives, which made they didn't have normal lives, which meant, this is not true of them all, of course, but it rather meant that their views were a bit lopsided and they became ardently feminist because of that. Now, I'm probably talking off the roof of my head because it's quite possible that your what is she called, Curry and the rest of them are all just as feminists as their predecessors were. But I have always felt that the only contribution that women have a right to make is that of a normal woman's point of view and not the extreme views of people who have extremes in their lives. I may be wrong, but that seemed to me to be the thing.
Are there any outstanding women you can think of?
Oh, of course, there's Nancy Astor, who was the first one ever. She was outstanding.
Could you tell me something about her?
Nancy Astor. Where have you got to? What did I say just now?
Nancy Astor, you're going to tell me something about her.
Well, Nancy Astor was a great friend of my family's in America. The famous Uncle Paul, which I keep mentioning, known as Miss Langan. And so when my husband and I went down to fight Southeast Cornwall as prospective candidates nearly 2 years before the election, he wrote to her to say, would she please give us every possible help? To which she had a very snappy answer back, saying, I wouldn't help her. I hope they're defeated. Isaac Foote, who was the gentleman we were trying to push out, is a teetotaler. And as we all know, Nancy Astor was an ardent teetotaler. He's one of my best supports in the House of Commons. I don't want to lose him. So I hope they'll be defeated. So that didn't go very well. Well, then the war came, and I must honestly say that she didn't want another American in the house. She really resented the fact that she didn't mind the other women members, but I was an American. I had no business to be there. She was the only one, and she wanted to be the only one. And she was a bit tricky with me. But she was such a character and such a remarkable woman that you put up with it. I mean, it didn't matter. I had one or two moments that were difficult, but you survive them. It doesn't matter. She was not pleased to have it. And my constituent in hers would have touched if it hadn't been for the Tamar River. It had nothing but that between us. So we were a little bit in each other's hair occasionally, but I was very much the junior animal. In fact, I was considered much too young to be in the House of Commons. I wouldn't have been as a man.
How old were you, Lady
Wright? I was 30, wasn't I? Yes, about 30. And a man of 30 is perfectly all right. But a woman of 30? Oh, no, she can't possibly know anything. Well, I didn't know much, that's true.
Did the composition change regarding men? You know, because a lot of them would have been of fighting age, wouldn't they?
Oh, there were any number who were in the forces.
So how did they cope?
Well, they coped exactly the way my husband did. The wives did the homework, and they came when they could. And the wives worked in the constituencies. At least that's one way of doing it. I don't know what they all did, because I wasn't on intimate terms with them, but that was roughly, you just had to continue. The secretary of a member of parliament, if she's a woman of ability, and I had a wonderful one, really does an enormous amount of they know what to do with these letters and appeals and things, and how to handle them, and how to help their member. They're very, very powerful people and very good. So I imagine they relied on their secretaries too.
I understand that the House of Commons, Westminster, the Palace of Westminster, was badly damaged by bombs during the war.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, it had many attacks. But the biggest one was in May. It was May.
You were saying
in May 1941 was the disastrous one. We had all sorts of bits and pieces before then, and indeed some after them. But it was after that that we were much more permanently, well, we had to be permanently, in what Churchill liked to call the annex, which was Church House. But very shortly after that, it was arranged that the House of Lords would let us have their chamber. So we moved back to the House of Lords, which is where we sat till the end of the war, and the Lords went into their robing room. Didn't like it much either, but they did. And then they got the House of Lords set up for us. And that was quite all right. There are wonderful photographs of it. But that was the worst raid.
Did you see the devastation yourself, Lady Wright?
Oh, yes, of course. Yes, we all saw it. Yeah.
What
the statue outside the big memorial window in along the embankment there of Prince Charles with his sword in the air. The sword was bent, and my husband and I thought it would be much better just to leave that bent, but they straightened it. They like to straighten a lot of things they could have left better just alone. It's just by the big window, which has the memorial windows to all the members, including my husband, the crest, their family crest, etc., when they were killed.
Were there many debates about the war itself?
Oh, they were all about the war.
Can you remember anything outstanding?
Well, they were all outstanding, because with Churchill conducting them, they were bound to be. He was very special.
D-Day, for instance, do you remember that in the House of Commons?
I certainly do. My husband was on Monty's staff and living with us in Dean's Yard. Well, he wasn't living at home, but living with me in Dean's Yard was Audrey Elworthy, the wife of the head of Bomber Command, who later became Minister of Defence after Mountbatten. I mean, not Minister, I mean Head of Defence, and then Governor of Windsor Castle, and who is godfather of my daughter, my youngest daughter. And his wife and I were very close friends, and she lived most of the war with me. It was he who told me of my husband's was missing. I think I mentioned before, you forget what you've said. And she was living with me at the time, and he drove me back where we were in Bicester because the house had been bombed in town. And it was no use my being fussy because her husband was going that very next evening, go out. He said, I'm going back for John, meaning my husband. If he was going to go and bomb, it was no use me kicking up. She had that to put up with for a long time. It was a miracle he ever survived. However, he and Paul, funnily enough, my husband was at 21 Army Group, and he was, I suppose, wherever the Bobber thing was, I don't know. And you couldn't ask them what the weather was. You could ask them nothing. They were incapable of answering a question because so much depended on secrecy, and no secret's ever been so well kept. In my own constituency, I went down shortly before when the American fleet was here, and Foy Harbor, which is the center of the constituency, you could walk across with American ships waiting for D-Day. It was solid ships. And I walked down the street with the mayor. We were doing something official, I know not what. And I said, goodness, Mr. Mayor, look at all that. Aren't there, my, what a lot of ships. And he looked and he said, I haven't noticed any. It was the way you felt. You were not going to say anything about anything. And the morning of D-Day, we were having breakfast. The two men, we asked them, would they, what time did the post go? And one said to the other, we don't know. And with that, they went out the house. And it was that, they knew, of course, which we didn't, that that was going to be D-Day. They didn't know what time the post went. They knew nothing. I went across to the House of Commons, and funnily enough, I ran into Anthony Eden, and we walked along, and neither of us said anything. You didn't. You didn't know how it was going to go. You didn't want to think about it. You just didn't want to know until the news was available. It was a very strange moment. Well, understandably so. However,
I wonder also about Russia, you know, how that featured in the debates in the House.
Well, what do you mean? Attacks at Stalingrad and all
yes,
that?
Yes, I was thinking, you know, Stalingrad was coming to my mind, you know, the sort of stand at Stalingrad, and which is...
Well, often, of course, the debates of the House of Commons were about everything, and I mean, it's very difficult to take your mind back to the exact dates, the debates such as you're asking me about. We discussed everything, of course. We never stopped.
Well, were
the House of Commons never stops talking, you know. They all go on all the time.
Well, as a young woman, you know, the youngest woman in the House, were you at all inhibited about talking, you know, speaking?
Of course you're inhibited. Mm. The one place you can let it, your top go in your constituency with chums around you. But in the House of Commons, you're very careful. You're very, start with you don't read your speeches ever. And you're very, I don't think anybody gets up in the House of Commons and makes a good speech unless he's frightfully nervous. You have to be. I mean, it's just one of those things.
Your maiden speech, you said that was about Norway.
Oh, no, it wasn't entirely about that. It was about a great many other things. It was just like any other maiden speech. You knew too much, you said too much, you didn't do it very well. I got better as time went on. Paul and I had a daughter born a year after we were married, the first child ever to be born to a woman member. We lived, as I said, in Dean's Yard, and the day when I would have to be looking after, they let me have a bit of help in the house, which would have been impossible otherwise. And there'd be a division when I was working in the office, and I'd push the pram across to the stranger's entrance, and I'd leave her with the police and go in and vote and come out again. She had quite a few friends in the police force by the end of the war, and our cat, we used to share our cat, which lived some of the time, a very fine cat, in Dean's Yard, and a good deal of the rest of the time on Winston Churchill's desk. He thought it was his cat. I knew it was my cat, and we'd never argued about it. When children returned from America, we were quite a household to manage with the bombs coming down, the V1 and V2s, what we were being blessed with at that time. And we had to find safe places to put them all, but I was awfully glad they were back. The two, Paulie Pitey, as we call her, and Tim, and Faith, we would send where we were. A great deal of the time they went to Cornwall, which seemed to be a safe place, until they were all established in their schools. But on May the 8th, when Churchill announced to the House that the war in Europe was over, we all, I think I've already said, we processed across to St. Margaret's. And then came the business of the general election, which I didn't wish to have any part in. Then I think you must stop because I'm getting lost.
Did he ever warm to you, you know, or to women?
No, he never warmed. He said he didn't warm to me. He didn't warm to women. Oh no, indeed not. Well, he couldn't. He was too busy.
I wonder what you thought also of Mr. Attlee.
Mr. Attlee, who, of course, became Prime Minister after the election, was a very nice, quiet, extraordinary little man. I didn't know him at all well, but I admired him for certain qualities.
And one thinks of people like Ernest Bevin and
Ernest
Herbert
Bevin,
Morrison.
Of course, was a wonderful man, He was Foreign Secretary, don't forget. But they come later into my life, you see, because after one goes on, it's a disease, you know. If you are interested in politics, it goes on all your life. And it's been a very portable interest to carry around the world when my husband started his foreign service career. Wherever you went, you could always find yourself interested in something. And the two things that I have always been most interested in are deafness and what can be done about it, because my mother was very, very deaf, and politics. So they're both transportable. They went everywhere, to Africa, to Cairo, you name it. They went everywhere with us. They're still with us now. I never miss the Tuesday or Thursday question time on the box. If I can possibly do so, if I can possibly... No, I never want to miss it.
I wonder what you make of it when you actually see the MPs today with their the debates, you know, and the question time issue. And
well, I don't make anything more of it than I would have if I was sitting there. It's just exactly the same as it ever was.
Is it the same?
Oh, yes. I think there are different tones. There are different emotions, and there are different ways of handling it. Mrs. Thatcher did one way, Mr. Major's doing it another way. It's all absolutely fascinating, of course, if you're interested. And I am. And Mr. Churchill did it another way. Because one of the great strengths in this country, as we all know, is the fact that be you Prime Minister or anything else in the government, you have to go to that House of Commons once a week and answer questions. In the United States, if one of the cabinet ministers is in trouble, he has a committee meeting. He calls a congressional committee. That can be once a year. But our chap has to go twice a week.
Do you think yourself, when you look back at your period in Westminster, the 4 years, do you think the situation for women MPs improved during the war?
I suppose it did a bit. It's hard to judge that. It's a very long time ago, and since then so much has happened in the sphere of women members and women in this, that, and the other. Whether as a result of the war, just evolution. I think, after all, the whole position of society after the 1418 war must have changed tremendously, so I'm told. I was a little bit too young even then. But after this war, equally it's changed. Your great permissive societies come in it's no use trying to analyze that because, of course, it goes on and on and on, the changing. But one of the interests, to go back a minute to the question of the Prime Minister and other ministers in the House of Commons, it's very interesting because it was, I think, A.P. Herbert who drew attention to the fact, I'm almost sure it was he, who drew attention to the fact that Mr. Hitler had to fight his way with the Gestapo, etc., and Churchill had to fight his way with question and answer. The one was a free thing, and the other was anything but free. And of course, Churchill wins the war. Hitler doesn't win. I think it's quite conclusive that it's as it was after all what we were fighting for, wasn't it?
It was interesting also, you know, what you were saying about this ideal of holding the post-war situation in mind. Your work, for instance, with the nurseries and the...
Well, they gave us that, I'm quite sure. The government, the Whip's Office, or whoever you like, gave us that work to keep us quiet. Because, you know, it was very important it had to be done. But they didn't really want to have us barking around their heels with ideas that how they could improve the day-to-day working of the war. They would much prefer they'd go, not just women, but members, the committees, select committees, were a valuable safety valve.
I was thinking of, say, the beverage plan, and whether or not that wouldn't have been part and parcel of it.
Oh, of course the beverage plan was a lovely distraction. Mm. Oh, yes, we had a lovely time with that.
Is that how you think of it, as a distraction?
Well, because it was in the war. It was nothing to do. I mean, one has to remember, you got out of bed in the morning and you were glad you were alive. You had a little bit of butter with your bread and that was your day's... I mean, you know, we were very rationed. Your life was so much simplified because there was no fanciness. I mean, you just got on with your work. So it was good that you had it to do. I mean, people who didn't have enough to do were the unhappy ones. One was grateful to be really busy. You didn't have time to worry.
I was very interested also in what you were saying about your constituents and the fact that, you know, the black troops were situated
well,
in
there's quite a little to say about that, but I think we'll leave that one alone because it really was quite a problem.
Yes.
You see, the American soldiers could only just say, I've never seen her. When they're confronted with Mabel's had a baby. No, I've never seen Mabel. I don't know who you're talking about. And the commanding officer said, okay, and it was forgotten. In fact, it was, a very funny story because the colonel in charge of all, some section of the American army, I can't remember, his name was Barnes, Colonel Barnes. And I complained to him. I said, look, really, you must look into this. I don't know what you can do for us, but I'm concerned because they give these girls nylon stockings and chocolates, and they also give them a baby, and that's a big mistake. And it's going to cause a lot of trouble when the war is over. So he said, well, now I've got... He asked me to come and have dinner in London to see Claire Luce, who was here officially in some capacity, I don't know what. She was high up in the American scene, and later, as you know, ambassador hither and yon. And she can help you. She can help you. So we sat down to dinner. Well, now, the American army was very well rationed. They had lovely food, so one looked forward to this sort of a meal. It was a great event, and I didn't do much talking. I was just enjoying having some food. And not that we were starving, but it was just a treat. And when the meal was over and we were all mellowed by our food, he said, now, Babs, he said, you just tell Claire exactly what you said to me. So I told her about these situations in Cornwall, in my constituency, and I said, what do you think? And she took a minute or two, and then she said, well, I'll tell you what I think. The blood of England has been running very thin for a long time. You ought to pay us per child. So that settled the whole argument. We laughed, and that was it. It was too late then to do much about it. But I expect they're still there in Cornwall. I haven't been back lately to count them. That's not the only part of England where it happened.
Were questions raised in the house, you know, about Americans generally?
Oh, yes, but very, very careful. I mean, here were our allies. They'd come over. They'd come into the war. We were awfully pleased to see them. Certainly nothing of that sort came up that I can remember. I wouldn't have remembered it, I think.
Do you remember anything coming up about the girls who married the GIs and were going back to America?
No, you see, that's later. That's later. And I was getting on to foreign service life. I was right out of it. Well, there's been any amount of talk in the papers, hasn't there? But I didn't. It was nothing to do with my days. About the war, yes, yeah. I think I was very, very fortunate, first of all, to have had the chance to be hard worked in the war, because you don't notice the disasters around you or your personal bereavements if you're kept really busy on something more important than yourself. And also, I was very fortunate that I found and was married to someone who had known my husband and who knew the children and was very fond of the children insofar as he knew them and became a wonderful stepfather, which they would be the first to admit, and also who opened a whole new chapter in the life of our family because we all are interested in each other, which was his going into the Foreign Service, which meant that we were sent wherever the office wanted to send us. And my son, who went out to America after he finished his military service and his university degree and worked there for a time, America has always been in our family a refresher and a battery builder. And he came back to this country and fell in with what he was always destined to do, which was politics, and he became the member for Lewis. So that the next chapter in our lives is to do with foreign travel and foreign interests, but it is very much to do with the fact that another Rathbone has gone into public life to follow work which generations of Rathbones have done, not always in the same political party, but have always been interested in and worked hard for. So it's very nice. I had my whack at it, his father had his whack at it, and my son is now having his, and I can share in that and enjoy every minute of it.
Lady Wright, thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
It's all right.